Welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're going to be doing our CISSP content, and specifically we're going to be looking at applying cryptography. You know, we've done a few episodes now on different types of cryptography, a lot of vocabulary, a lot of information there. Now we want to take a look at actually putting it in place, using it, some of the ways we do that, and here to help us with that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
Good, good. Let's talk a little bit about applying cryptography. Really, applying cryptography is first and foremost about reviewing what we already know about cryptography, right? Because in order to apply it, we've got to make sure we understand it. Now, we've spent a lot of time, you've invested a lot of your time in watching the episodes. Mike and I spent a lot of time preparing them and delivering them to you so you understand what those things are. We're not going to redo that whole thing because that would take way too long and Mike would then throw down the microphone and walk out in protest. So we're not going to do that. What we are going to do is just quickly remind you about what the cryptographic process looks like. And what I mean is simply we take plain text, we run it through some sort of cryptographic system, which is effectively an algorithm using one or more keys, either a private key or a private public key pair, to change. To effectively transform the plain text into what we call ciphertext. That's if we run through it in ciphering. If we are going to decipher, we effectively run it backwards. We run it in reverse. We take ciphertext, run it back through the crypto system, and out the far end comes plain text. So if we start from that assumption with the cryptographic process being defined as such, then we can talk about the different things that are associated with it. We're not going to go back and have that whole conversation again about different key types. We're not going to talk about symmetric versus asymmetric. We're not going to talk about why we need a public key versus a private key. We've done all that. But what we are going to remind you of is that the use of cryptography is fundamentally important to ensure confidentiality and potentially to ensure integrity, depending on what we're doing. There are different types of cryptography. One of the ones we haven't talked about until now is something called quantum cryptography, which is a relatively newer version of cryptography. It uses the laws of science as opposed to the laws of mathematics, which do underlie the laws of science. But specifically, we're going to use the laws of physics in order to be able to effectively secure data using quantum cryptography. Now, quantum cryptography is primarily still a theoretical construct because we need quantum computers in order to be able to use quantum cryptography. We are moving in this direction slowly but surely, and over time, and most likely within who knows how long, maybe 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, hard to say exactly how long, but within our lifetime, most likely, quantum cryptography and quantum computers will actually be available and they will be a reality. Effectively, what we do today is we use computers based on a very established and well-known and well-understood model, but a model that has limitations. A quantum computer is going to be a very different animal entirely. It's going to be based on the laws of physics and the way in which energy is transformed in order to be able to effectively achieve transformation. We have to understand how to manage energy in different forms. And when we can build a quantum computer in anything other than a very expensive science lab, moving protons around from here to there and spelling out IBM, which was what the example of quantum computing that actually has occurred up until now was. So somebody has successfully done this, but they've done it on a very small scale is what I'm suggesting to you. When we could translate that into a production level quantum computer that's commercially available, then quantum cryptography will actually be something to consider. But the idea is that basically the ideas around security and cryptography that we know of today will be radically transformed by applying the same laws, the same rules of physics that help us to understand the universe to the idea of a quantum computer as well as quantum cryptography to safeguard information within a computer. So just a look ahead, if you will, into the future. Remember that cryptographic systems provide confidentiality, potentially integrity, and certainly safeguard and provide for availability. But they also do other things. We've talked about non-repudiation, we've talked about authentication, and access control as being additional features of cryptographic systems. So we just want to make sure we're aware of those. We remind ourselves of those as well. The cryptographic life cycle, the idea of effectively taking plain text, ciphering it into or enciphering it into ciphertext, has been well explained, hopefully, and well understood by you. The cryptographic life cycle is considered to be broken when somebody figures out how to steal the key or somehow compromise it and effectively without permission and without rights, decipher data that should be kept confidential. So we do want to make sure we understand that a cryptographic function can be broken. And we do want to make sure we understand what would break a cryptographic function. Algorithm and/or protocol guidance and governance is also important. We've talked about some places you can get guidance from this than other places like that. We've talked about making good choices. Governance overall should be applied to these architectural decisions. Things such as cryptographic policies, the use of acceptable standards, the understanding of how to use procedures that will minimally provide certain protections, but also minimally impact us negatively and minimize risk are also very important. Approved cryptographic algorithms and key sizes, for instance, should be stipulated in policies before we implement systems. So we talked about the issues associated with the usage of DES today and the fact that we moved away from DES towards AES and other algorithms that are considered to be stronger because they have variable key sizes that are bigger overall than the key space that, or rather the key size that DES was using to implement. As a result of that, a policy would stipulate that we should use only the most secure algorithms, and we should test the security, the veracity of those algorithms, in other words, should be challenged and tested on a yearly basis. This will be an acceptable usage policy for algorithms and a good way to make a choice about the best possible algorithms available at the time. So this will be one example of what we're talking about. We should have key generation, key management, key escrow, key lifecycle capabilities built into our crypto systems. And we'll talk about them in a little more depth here over the next few minutes. We want to make sure we have policies and standards that guide that. NIST has some very good documentation recommendations for this. And it's one of the places you can look at to figure out how to do this if you're not sure what to do and specifically how to do this. Obviously, keep in mind and understood that as part of any risk analysis, looking at the impact of cryptography is going to be central to what we do. We've talked about the fact it could be a value add and could prevent exposure of confidentiality, so effectively can minimize risk. But we also talked about the fact there is risk directly associated with the use of cryptography. If we lose the keys, for instance, right, the private key, if we lose that key and we cannot decrypt the data, we effectively run the risk of not being able to use the information anymore. This in and of itself should be identified as a risk and should be assessed as such. And we've talked about the importance and significance of this also. We may also want to touch on theoretically as well as actually whether we are going to export the encryption controls that we are using. So we will we export the algorithms, for instance, like AES? Will we make them available to anybody who wants to use them? Will we tightly control them and only make them available to certain friends or third-party countries that stipulate that they will obviously abide by certain rules in their use? Certain algorithms and certain encryption solutions are not available worldwide. There are certain countries that are on blacklists that effectively are prevented from being able to buy and use these algorithms because we are concerned, the U.S. or other countries, are concerned that they will get these algorithms and effectively try to use them to do a variety of things, none of which we would obviously think are acceptable. So we talked about things in one of our very early discussions, one of the earlier episodes, in the system engineering as well as in the other conversations we had about standards such as ITAR and Wassenaar, the arrangements that allow us to control and to minimize the use of dual-use goods and technologies because we're afraid that things like encryption controls may fall into the wrong hands. So we want to keep that in mind, and a CISSP has to be thinking about these things as well. In order to then bring all this together, what we have to do is delve a little bit deeper into some of the technology I mentioned when we were talking about assessment of vulnerabilities, and we've spent all that time drilling into the discussion on encryption. We want to revisit, in other words, the discussion about PKI, and we want to revisit the discussion about digital certificates and bring key management to bear around those discussions in order to make this kind of a full circle, but also to give you a better picture, if you will, of how PKI and certificates are going to act and look and how we can use them to achieve the end results we're looking for, which is secure transmission and secure communication of that overall discussion. So, or rather, of the overall information related to the discussion. So when we think about PKI, we can see on the screen in front of us that we have a diagram that helps to bring to life the thought process about PKI, or public key infrastructure. That's what PKI stands for. We have a root certificate authority sitting at the top of the diagram up there. There are some arrows flowing down into what are known as intermediate CAs. CA just stands for certificate authority generically. Although I like saying that over and over and over again, we're just going to abbreviate that going forward. So a root CA can be of one of two types, either an enterprise root CA or a standalone root CA. An enterprise root CA is going to be associated with a directory namespace, so an LDAP directory, whereas a standalone root CA, a standalone enterprise root CA, creating a third category of root CAs. So we have an enterprise root CA associated with the directory service. We have a standalone root CA, which is going to, obviously, as the name implies, be outside the directory service, not connected to it, but is still able to act as a root, act as the basis for the issuing of certificates to intermediate and subordinate CAs, which will then ultimately create what we know of as a chain of trust. And we're going to demonstrate that by showing you a live certificate here in just a moment. But before we get there, let's just make sure we understand how we actually issue certificates. So the root CA is going to issue certificates to either an intermediate and or a subordinate CA. So the arrows pointing down through the hierarchy as we create the pyramid is going to or are going to represent that issuing. Those certificates are then going to be allowed to be used down below the level that they're issued at to validate things like the digital signature, to validate the identity, to validate the service that is being offered. They could be attached, as you see at the bottom there, with the stick figures to either Bob or Alice, although we haven't named them, they're anonymous today, and or computers that are going to be sitting there, either a laptop, a desktop, whatever, a mobile device. We can associate them with all sorts of things over there. And we can see that certificates, in other words, are good for both users as well as for computers. And we often will enroll a user certificate and or a computer certificate for dual use. So we can digitally sign and we can also do other things with it, for instance. So we want to make sure we understand the general hierarchy. Now what we want to do is we want to go ahead and we want to take a look at what a real certificate looks like. So certificates, and Mike's going to help me by bringing up the certificate. Let's just make sure you're clear on where we are so you don't just randomly see this list and wonder what we're looking at. We're in Mike's web browser. We're in Google Chrome, and in Google Chrome, Mike's gone to the settings to manage advanced settings. He's gone to manage certificates, and he's brought up the certificate store that is there, and we're just highlighting or looking at one or more of the certificates that are going to be there. Mike's going to double-click on one and bring it up for us so we can see what's in there. We're going to zoom in a little bit, I think, hopefully, and be able to see that, or Mike's going to try to figure out how we can zoom in while we're talking. But let me just tell you something important about it, and even if we can't zoom in, I'll kind of explain what's there. It's not a big deal. We have an X509V3 certificate, and we want to make sure we know what type of certificate we're using. X.509, which is the certificate standard, X.509 is the standard, V3, version 3. And so X.509V3 certificates are used today, and certificates represent digital trust. They represent the ability to validate and prove identity and to validate and prove source and origin. And they represent the ability to validate and to push forward and to effectively transfer trust between parties. And so what we see in a certificate are a bunch of fields. They are listed there. And I know it may be a little difficult for you to see them because it is a little small on the screen. So we understand that. We'll just call out some of the highlights for you, at least to tell you what's there. We're going to have an algorithm that's used for the signature. So it's going to list somewhere in the field there what algorithm was used, whether it was RSA or whether it was SHA-1 or, you know, whatever it may be. There may be different choices there. We're going to have the issuer name. So we're going to have the X500 LDAP aligned directory name of the certificate authority. So the issuing name will be there. We're going to have the period of validity, very important. The certificate was issued from this or on this particular day, good for this many days, weeks, months, years, you know, whatever that may be. Root certificates are usually good for a very long period of time. Intermediate and subordinate CA certificates, not so long, much shorter period of time. Certificates issued to a user typically are good for about 12 months on average, but that may change. You have the right to adjust that. The subject's name, so the owner of the public key, who is the subject, that's going to be a field that's there. The digital signature of the CA, of the certificate authority, will be there. This will be represented by a hash, and we could see some hash values on various lines. Probably down towards the bottom is where Mike's pointing. That'll be there. So there's lots of different things that will show up in the certificate fields. We want to make sure we know that the certificates are going to represent not just the issuer, but also the owner of the certificate. So the person who issued it or the entity that issued it, but also the target of it, the subject that's going to use it. It represents both. And we have to make sure that we understand the concept of trust when we talk about certificates, because trusts are very important. Now, I'm not in the habit of walking around with money in my pocket, right? But on occasion, I do have paper money as opposed to credit cards with me. But when I do, if I turn over a dollar bill, a United States dollar bill, I will see on the back of our currency the words, "In God we trust," right? So "In God we trust." See, four words. They're usually on the masthead of the bill somewhere on the back. Now, what we're talking about there is not in theory, as well as in actuality, that we are going to expect that God is going to actually give us the ability to have goods and services in exchange for that dollar bill. What we're implying, right, is a statement of several things. And without getting into the reality, the religiosity of that conversation, I'm not going to go down that road with us. What I'm simply going to say is that when we talk about something like "In God We Trust" on the back of the currency, what we're implying is that the full faith and value of that dollar or that amount of currency is backed by the United States government in the case of U.S. currency. And we are saying, ultimately, that there has to be trust between the issuer of the good and service and the consumer of the good and service that has the currency. And the exchange of those two things implies trust. It implies that the value of that good and service is going to be equal to the amount of money that we give. And if it's less than that, we get change. And if it's more, we give some back, right? Or we give some more. So the idea is that there has to be trust in any of these things that we do. And certificates allow us to distill down trust into a digital representation of what that means. What that ultimately means to us when we think about certificates is that the issuer has said that the holder of this certificate is allowed to operate with the full trust and backing and faith of the issuer on their behalf to execute the actions that the certificate implies are available to them. Whether it is a digital signature to validate email, whether it is to validate a web page, whether it is to provide non-repudiation and integrity, whatever it may be, those certificates are going to be backed by the issuer, in this case, the root CA, intermediate or subordinate CA. So we just want to make sure we understand what a certificate is and why it's so important to us. When we think about key management, which is really what goes into the idea of now that we have certificates and we've issued them, how do we actually keep track of them? How do we ultimately understand how long they're good for and what do we do with them? Certificates are going to be a derivative of a public key traditionally that's used to effectively create the certificate. And as a result of that, we have to think about key management, because key management is all about the art and science of issuing keys securely, keeping them around for a period of time, and then getting rid of them when we no longer need them and decommissioning them. We have a life cycle. So a very famous person came up with a statement about key management and the crypto system in general, a guy named Kirchhoff. And Kirchhoff's law, which is what we want to talk about with regards to key management, basically says a crypto system should be secure even if everything in it is known, is made available publicly, with one exception. That exception should be knowledge of the key. And so what Kirchhoff talked about is the idea that if we keep one thing secret in a system, one thing and one thing only, and that thing is the key, in our case, the private key, right? If we keep the private key secure, everything else is known. All the other stuff is publicly available, and that knowledge is going to be seen and made available anywhere in the system, then the system will still be secure, because the private key by itself is enough to safeguard and create the integrity and the confidentiality we need in the system, provided that we keep that key secure. And our conversations about how we can safeguard information, how we can use either the recipient's public key or the sender's private key to provide for the appropriate transmission, we've talked a lot about that. We're just simply reminding you of that by summarizing it up in Kirchhoff's law. You would want to be familiar with Kirchhoff's law. It's probably a good idea to know what that law says and effectively what it means. Segregation of duties, we've talked about this before. We talked about the idea that we should split up roles and as a result of that, give one or more people different roles and responsibilities so that way one person is not in charge of everything. This makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because if we segregate duties, what we're saying is the person that is going to be able to effectively back up data should not be the same person that can restore data. That's one example of how segregation of duties may work. And because of that, we are trying to avoid malicious behavior and abuse of the system. So segregation of duties is also important here. We want to juxtapose, compare that with what's known as dual control or split knowledge. These are also terms that become very important. Dual control is going to be implemented as a security procedure where we're going to have more than one person, typically two people, that are going to, or at least more than one person, come together to effectively be able to carry out some sort of activity. So with dual control, we have at least two people involved that may have to insert keys into a system and, you know, turn them to launch a weapon or something like that, kind of classic example, right, of that. So split knowledge is going to be the ability to effectively give multiple pieces of knowledge, parts of the puzzle, to individuals, have them bring them all together to solve the problem and carry out the activities, what split knowledge implies. So split knowledge systems will involve effectively maybe giving out a portion of a key, and then bringing all those keys together effectively allows us to carry out the action. I don't know if you've ever seen these, you know, they're very popular with you know, young kids, girls especially, right? The little broken heart pendants where they give it to a friend. Oh, you're my best friend. And, you know, they break the heart pendant. They give you half. You have half. You know, and then as a result, you bring them together. You're, you know, besties, right? So, you know, that's an example of split knowledge, because split knowledge is the idea of having something that's a whole, the heart pendant, broken up and then given to individuals. And they have to bring that back together in order to effectively see the whole picture, right? To be besties, you need the broken heart. So just be aware of that. So when we think about key storage and destruction, we talked about key life cycle, talked about managing keys, issuing them securely, keeping them safe during their use. What about when we have to destroy them, right? When they're no longer valid anymore, when they're no longer good, when they've been compromised, we have to get rid of them. We don't just throw them in the garbage. I mean, theoretically, you could, but the reality is that's not the approved way of destroying keys. Keys are digital solutions, right? They are effectively going to be strings, alphanumeric strings of letters and numbers. They may be thousands of characters long, but they are strings of characters. So we could just delete them off a system. But the reality is, deleting them, as we know from prior discussions, is going to lead to data remnants. They will be left behind, in other words, potentially, and may be recoverable. So we have to securely delete them, securely destroy them. We can't just simply hit the delete button and delete the file. We have to make sure that they are stored securely, trusted and tamper-proof, tamper-resistant storage, using something like a TPM, a trusted platform module, or an HSM, a hardware security module, or a software security module. They're called different things. But the idea is that we store them in these containers while they're in the system. They are tamper-resistant, tamper-proof, so if you try to break into them, the keys are destroyed. They are effectively shredded, meaning they are encrypted, and then the encryption keys are destroyed, so that way you can't get to them and unencrypt the keys. Crypto shredding, or being able to re-encrypt the data, in effect, is a very effective method of destroying data securely, provided we get rid of the new encryption keys. So we effectively get rid of those keys and do so securely and effectively render the data inoperable. So we want to make sure we understand that storage is important, but destroying is equally important. We have to overwrite, we may have to degauss, we may have to do various things to get rid of those keys if they're digital. If they're written down somewhere, it may be easier, right? We can burn the paper, we can shred it, we can do various things to get rid of it. If we have multiple copies, we can go around and gather them up and destroy them. But ultimately, we have to figure out how to destroy keys successfully and to make sure they're not recoverable. We also want to keep in mind that if certificates are compromised, there may be a cost associated with revoking them and then reissuing them. Every so often, you hear about a certificate being compromised. Somebody loses the certificate, something happens, malware may infect the system, may become compromised. And as a certificate administrator, we may have to go in and revoke that certificate, use what's called a CRL, certificate revocation list, and then create a brand new one. Now, in and of itself, that's really not a very expensive thing to do. You know, one certificate every so often, not a big deal. But what if that was a root certificate from a major software vendor like Microsoft or Google, right, or somebody like that, who effectively has issued that certificate to hundreds of millions of individuals to effectively establish trust? Now, all of a sudden, it's not so easy to reissue a brand new certificate. It is, but what I'm saying is the pushing of the button is not the hard part. The disseminating that out to hundreds of millions of individuals that have to get rid of the old certificate and replace it with a new one is incredibly complicated, time-consuming, and expensive. So this is something to be aware of as well. So we want to make sure we can safeguard certificates and keys, but if they are lost for any reason and compromised, we have to be prepared to take action. Key recovery is one of those actions we may take. If the key is lost, not compromised, but lost, we may be able to recover it. So if we have only a single private key, and we don't make a copy of it, and we lose the key, we're done, right? We can go home. There's nothing else to discuss. But if we have a copy of the key, and we store that key copy somewhere securely, off-site or with a trusted third party or through an escrow solution, wherever it is, we can recover that key potentially given the right circumstances. So multi-party or third-party key recovery is an option. We can split up the key and store it in different places and have copies available. We may store it with what's known as an escrow agent. An off-site trusted third party, but a single entity as opposed to multiple parties that will be given information and instructions about how to safely store the key for a fee. Obviously, you know, we'll pay them. And then under certain circumstances, we probably have to validate certain information, maybe provide written attestation about whatever we need done. There may be a process, in other words, typically associated with this. When we show up, we can't just say, hey, I'm there to get the key. Can I have Bob's key, please? Right? It's not quite that simple. So we may have to go through a process to identify ourselves. But assuming we meet the criteria associated associated with key recovery, we will be given a copy of the key, which can then be used to ultimately go ahead and recover the data. So we do want to understand key recovery and how it works. It is very important. And key escrow is also going to be very important in this regard. We want to be thinking about that and be aware of that. Along with certificates and digital certificates and keys, we also want to think about how we create the ability to manage data and to effectively use digital information and to use trust to our advantage. We think about something known as DRM, or digital rights management, effectively applying safeguards to data so that it cannot be compromised without our knowledge. So one of the biggest issues we have in the modern systems we create in enterprise content management platforms, for instance, like SharePoint, like WebSphere, is that we store huge volumes of data in the web or in the cloud via the web. We access them. And the problem becomes we may not understand how to apply access controls properly. And so somebody may be able to get to the data and see it within the interface, but we may not want them to remove it. And if they can remove it, the attributes, right, the protection attributes are not sticky. We call them sticky if they stay with the data. If they're not sticky, the data itself may be removed from the system, and the attributes don't go with the data. The data, in other words, is unprotected. And this is obviously a very bad state of affairs to find ourselves in. So as a result of that, what we do is we use DRM technology. DRM technology allows us to apply sticky attributes to the data. So no matter where the data goes, effectively it stays protected. We can say you can see the data, but you can't print it. You may be able to read it, but only inside a certain application with a certain reader, and you may not be able to screen capture it. So you cannot take a picture of it, at least not in the system. You may say, well, I'll pull out my camera, because I have an app for that, and that's why I hate apps. And I can go ahead and I can take a picture. So yeah, you could do that. I can't prevent that from happening with DRM. I have this conversation all the time with students. Some bright person in the room says, well, what about taking a picture? Well, yeah, I could do that, right? The point is, I can't prevent everything, but I can prevent most things, right? Like go-karts going down the road, for instance. We have to make sure, right, that we understand how to safely coexist with the technology and the solutions that we're dealing with, especially if they're homemade go-karts. It's very important. So when we think about digital rights management, what we're thinking about is the safety of the data, right? If we build a system that has sticky attributes associated with it, what we can do is we can make sure that when the data leaves the system, we're not able to print it. We're not able to potentially open it under certain circumstances. We may not be able to send it via email. We may not be able to forward it if we do get it via email. There's lots of things that we can do with DRM. So data rights management or digital rights management technology is very comprehensive today, and it's one of the key ways that we implement security and safeguarding when we think about applying cryptography. That is what we're talking about, how we apply cryptography in different situations, different solutions through PKI, use of digital certificates, with DRM technology, for instance, one of the ways we do that. Lots of different ways. And there's different types of DRM. There's what we call always-on DRM. As the name implies, it's always on. There may be DRM associated with a USB key, so you may be able to use a USB key fob to enable the DRM solution or be able to transfer data onto removal media but have the attribute stick. There's different ways DRM may be implemented today. What we want to think about are things like digital watermarks, right, where we put digital watermarks into the background of a document. You've probably seen those, right, where they have the, you know, do not print, authorize use only or whatever that shows up on every page. You may not see it when you read it, but when you go to print it, it's there. It's kind of a light watermark. You know, those kind of things are property of, so people know where you got it from. Those are all DRM solutions. Those watermarkings and those fingerprintings of the data, being able to insert random character strings, will look like random character strings, into the digital data, but it's actually a digital fingerprint that, when stitched back together, uniquely tags the data, is another form of DRM that we use as well. It's called fingerprinting or digital fingerprinting today. So I want to just be thinking about that and be aware of that as well. We've talked a lot about hashing as well as digital signatures and what hashing is used for. Remember, creating integrity is really what hashing is all about. Digital signatures provide non-repudiation and proof of origin. We want to make sure we understand what those things are as well as we think about hashing. We think about applying cryptography and hashing, I should say. When we think about hashing, what we want to also understand is what the hashing algorithms are that we can use. I mentioned a couple of them already. We've talked about MD5. We've talked about SHA-1. I mentioned that MD5 produces a 128-bit hashing output, so the bit stream is 128 bits. I mentioned that SHA-1, which is short for SHA-160, is going to produce 160-bit output streams. We want to know that. We also want to know there are some other hashing algorithms, maybe not as frequently used, maybe not as popular, right? But still very important to be aware of. Haval, which is one of the ones that's out there. is going to potentially produce a bitstream output that's variable, anything from 128 bits to 160, 192, 224, or 256 bits. So it has potentially five different variable outputs that it can produce. There's also RIPE-MD160. RIPE-MD160 is going to be a 160-bit output block, but it operates similar to what MD5 is. So it actually looks like an MD5 hash, but it produces 160-bit output instead of 128-bit output. Let me, again, be clear about that, because my my powers of enunciation are quickly, slowly but surely and quickly escaping me here. All right, so as we are talking about ways we apply cryptography in this episode, we've really been talking about the different mechanisms that we can use, some review, some a little bit more in detail as we've gone back and drilled down on the ways we can practically apply cryptography. In our next episode that's going to come up, that we're going to talk about kind of our part two of applying cryptography, we're going to take a look at how we break crypto systems. So understanding how to apply cryptography is important. Understanding how it can be attacked, and therefore what we have to do to mitigate ultimately and defend, is going to be the subject of our next conversation.
Very good, Adam. Again, a lot of great information there. You know, looking at that applied cryptography, taking what we've learned in the previous episodes and seeing how we actually implement it, how it actually helps me protect my information, my data, my websites, whatever it is we're trying to protect out there in the real world. So thanks for that, Adam. Remember, if you guys want to attend one of Adam's classes live, shoot us an email, cadam@itpro.tv. That's going to do it for this episode. Signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.